Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. The world has lost a living saint. Nelson Mandela, the first president of a free South Africa, was an example of the power of non-violent resistance, a symbol of hope for those fighting racism, poverty, and tyranny. His mark on history is indisputable. But what will his story mean for us in years to come? What will Nelson Mandela's legacy be for South Africa, for Britain, and for the world? I'm joined in the studio by the Telegraph columnists Peter Oborn, Sue Cameron, and Mary Riddell. Let's start by discussing the state that he leaves South Africa in. Mary, what's Nelson Mandela's legacy for that country?
Well, the legacy, as for the rest of the world, really, is that he managed to make a movement of liberation, the ANC, into a moral and a global crusade, the sort of feat that's eluded other parties of resistance, such as ZANU-PF and MPLA in Angola. But the sad truth, really, is that the South Africa that he leaves behind, and this is through no fault of Mandela, is not, I think, the sort of South Africa he would have wanted to have created or bequeathed. Obviously, there have been huge dividends in the years since apartheid ended. At the same time, South Africa is a very, very divided nation. The ANC is a party where, you know, the leaders tend to live high on the hog now. And poverty, obviously, is rampant. I think in 2008, the poorest 50% had about 7% of the 7.8%, I think, of the country's wealth. And that division, if you go to South Africa, I was in Johannesburg a few weeks ago, it's very evident, the sort of culture of bling and materialism, big shops, even in Mandela Square, with a huge shopping mall attached
to it. So why did Nelson Mandela fail to address these things? Why wasn't that inequality addressed under his leadership?
Well, I think in fairness to Mandela, this came long, really, after his time. By then, he was a very old man. And as I say, I don't think any of this can be laid at Mandela's feet. But those who followed him, the ANC, I think, lost its bottle, perhaps lost its nerve in a way, and didn't stand up for the things that the people of South Africa, who had invested it with their great faith, and it is a party, you know, that's that is still the only show in town. Mm-hmm. It hadn't lived up to those expectations, and I guess in very simple terms, Tim, it sort of sold out to the neoliberals, many in the ANC would
Peter,
say to capitalism.
Peter, would you agree with that verdict?
Yeah, I haven't been as recently as Mary, but when you go to South Africa, you get a sense the ANC is now a sort of almost a gangster regime. It's a horrible alliance between the very rich whites, the former nationalists, so-called Nationalist Party, and the ANC. It's a one-party state. And I think Nelson Mandela was one of the greatest men ever to walk this earth. I didn't say I didn't want to. But I do actually wish he had spoken out more. I mean, there are things in his retirement where I think he had such an unlimited moral authority. And he made the decision, which is an admirable decision, and not, you know, which is, you know, that his time had gone. And you know, say it would have been lovely if he'd spoken out about some of the things Mugabe was doing in Zimbabwe, and he was in a position to have done that. It would have been lovely if he'd said some things about the conduct of the ANC. That said, I mean, I still think that South Africa is a wonderful place, and it is. You know, if you think about the legacies of the post-colonial situations across the rest of the world, you know, mm-hmm. Congo.
Well, and Ethiopia. in Mandela's defense, he was inheriting a very difficult political situation, and had he tried to address economic inequality rather than focus on the building of a democracy, then he might have had even greater problems. Sue?
I feel slightly that the tragedy is that during his lifetime, South Africa came such an unbelievably long way. And in the end, as we've said, those who remained behind didn't live up to the sort of standards he'd set. I think that it may have been a wise decision. Who knows? There have been people who have entered into the current political fray, having got great achievements behind them, and it can almost damage their original legacy. And I do think, when you read what his own account of his life, I mean, when he was, one of the things that sticks in my mind is that when he was a young man, the custom at the time, which just seems incredible today, is that he was walking along the street, I think, with his cousin. They were both of sort of the royal house or descended from chiefs. And a white man came up to his cousin and said, I think, oh, just go and buy me a newspaper or go and post this for me. And it was they didn't know this man. They hadn't worked for him. And apparently, Mandela explains that that was just how things were. And white men would come up to black guys and just order them to do some service for them. And Mandela says that if he'd been asked, he might have done it. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the sort of the humility of the man, that it's so much an important part of his healing abilities never stands on his dignity and he admits his weaknesses. I think that's what makes him such a great
I think player. You're entirely right. I mean, whenever people talk about the state of South Africa, they tend, understandably, to focus on poverty. But what defined the apartheid state was, of course, its racism. And that's what's hopefully changed. But it is indeed what has largely changed, as the old structures of apartheid have gone. And that change might be invisible because poverty is left behind and that's more visual and we can sort of understand it better. But the change in race relations is remarkable.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, it eats quite not that long ago, given how long he lived. It's not that long ago. And it still just seems amazing that you had this institutionalized system of dividing white from black and from coloureds. I mean, it's just appalling.
Mary.
But other things have changed as well, you know. I mean, Mandela, don't forget, was the son of a polygamous marriage. I think his wife was the third of his father's existing four wives. And even there you see his humanity, his ability to see both sides, because he says that he's against polygamy and it's not, we can't put up with it for women. It is completely unjustified. But, he says, on the other hand, when you were the child of a polygamous family, all the wives, all the mothers treated all the children as their own children.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very warm and inclusive, terrific family relationship.
A nightmare for birthdays, though. Mary?
I think the point about race is obviously very well made. But also, another huge change is the fact that South Africa was such this is stating the obvious, but such a repressive, such a closed state. I mean, I remember being blacked from South Africa shortly before apartheid ended for no greater crime than to go than for writing about what was going on in one of the black townships, and for that I received the letter. Lots of journalists did at the time, I think, saying that, you know, I wouldn't be allowed back into South Africa through any port of entry. And that remained until that ban remained in place until the end of apartheid. But just returning very briefly to Peter's very interesting point about Mandela and what he might or might not have said in his latter years. And I think perhaps the West can be held a little sort of responsible for the way they fashioned in his lifetime the myth of Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
You know, towards the end of his life, he was a very old man, and the pictures started to appear, the sort of celebrity shots of him and the Spice Girls, European leaders, certainly British leaders, kind of went to worship at his feet and turned him into a sort of human shrine almost.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they projected an awful lot of themselves onto him, I suppose.
And have projected a lot of Western capitalism as well onto
quite.
Him in its imagery. Because we often forget that, you know, his revolution happened in the early 90s, just after the Berlin Wall had fallen, after socialism had been largely discredited. So he was sort of severed from the history of his own movement, which had included a lot of Marxists and which was economically egalitarian. He instead finds himself running the country during a period of globalization at its zenith in the 1990s and free trade at its zenith. Mm. So it's not necessarily what he would have wanted, not necessarily his fault that that's the path South Africa took. That's simply what the world expected South Africa to do. And he really was held to that test of, will South Africa be crazy and socialist and a banana republic, in inverted commas, or will it embrace free trade?
Go on, since we're in a West-bashing mode, let's... just remember why he came to power. It was simple as it was as nightfall as day. The end of the Cold War. Simonstown was a vital. As long as the Cold War was going on, Simonstown was a vital base of essential strategic interest to the West. So Simonstown no longer matters after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and George Bush authorizes the change of regime in South Africa. We'd supported the regime in South Africa. We'd enabled it. Britain had. We were therefore complicit in Mandela's long period in jail. We were complicit in apartheid. It was part of the anti-Soviet system. It is a matter of total and utter shame. Particularly, I believe, and I say this as somebody who loves the Telegraph and loves the Conservative Party was shameful, where the refusal to go for sanctions. The Telegraph has a very unfortunate record here. We have to acknowledge something on the right, that Mandela was, I think, in the last century, there were two people who were comparable to Jesus Christ, Gandhi and Mandela. And the left understood that, the right didn't. I think the right was right on most of the ideological divides, but this great issue, the right has to acknowledge that it was unspeakably wrong.
And there's an article by Suzanne Moore in The Guardian arguing exactly that a lot of conservatives now praise Mandela, but that wasn't always the position that many on the right took.
No, it's absolutely not.
And that he has, since the 1990s, he's become reinvented, sort of almost depoliticized as a symbol of sainthood. And I think a lot of people who 20 years ago despised him seem to have rediscovered him as a symbol of sainthood.
Could I just sort of butt in quickly? And since Peter is being so very honest about the flaws of the right in the past, if I could just say that I think the left has something to consider and some soul searching to do too, in a different kind of way. And I think that in over sanctifying Mandela, the left in general, and I'm speaking very broadly, has failed to look as closely as it might, both in and outside South Africa, at actually what's happening on the ground. There's always a possibility of backsliding, of regression, particularly in Africa. It's only a few weeks, it was August, I think, the Marikana massacre, when 34 striking miners were killed by police. And that brought back echoes of Sharpeville in 1960, which was responsible, of course, for recruiting a great many people to the ANC in the first place. So while, of course, Mandela will be quite rightly remembered with veneration, will be honoured for all that he achieved, I think the left has to be careful about.
And some of those post-colonial, liberation movements were themselves quite tyrannical, and the left in this country tended to celebrate them without question. I mean, Kayunda was essentially a dictator. Nairi's economic policies were absolutely disastrous. I think there's a case for saying that both made mistakes. Sue.
I absolutely see where Peter's coming from, and I think I agree with him. But there is a sort of almost an eternal problem for stable countries as we were. Do you go in and use sanctions against any wicked regime, or do you go more slowly and try and have an influence on them? And sometimes one thing can be better, sometimes another. And I think that it's unfair sometimes to automatically damn them because they didn't do more at the time. What would have happened? Would it really have made a difference? I think that's something ask.
There was that element, which I think, and you can argue, Charles Moore, our very distinguished colleague, argues that was broadly Maggie Thatcher's position. But there was also a strong element in the Tory party which really was disgusting on this issue, the Hang Mandela element. And the Tory MP's backbench licensed member, John Carlyle, I think he's still alive, the member for Johannesburg North, or whatever he was.
Yes.
And I hope I'm thinking of John Carlyle at the moment. I would like him to apologise to all of us, but I don't suppose he would dream of that. And I think that we are entitled to be angry and ashamed. I mean, it's not... we've got to bear in mind that many people did not rise... Many people did splendidly rise to the occasion. Many people didn't.
I think that you... I mean, you said there were two groups, but roughly speaking, in the Tory party. I don't think you should automatically lump them all together. I mean, I agree with you.
No, and let's also, in the spirit of the occasion, remember those who did do good and who did stand up with Mandela. What, Mary, was the significance of Nelson Mandela for the Labour Party and for the left in this country, broadly, excluding those parts which didn't like him, but broadly, what was the meaning of Mandela for those people?
Well, I think Mandela was the great symbolic figure, the sort of living proof that good men, that one good man, obviously, in his case, could change the world. And the fact that the ANC was so much more than a military movement, than a movement of war and a movement of protest.
But you were wrong to say he was about non-violent protest.
Yes, I mean, because he wasn't.
Of course, and there were certainly elements of that within the ANC. It was a very, very sort of broad church. All I'm saying is that it did contain other elements. I think for the left, he was the emblem of the perfectibility, I suppose, or at least the capacity for huge improvement and transformation in very, very flawed states. Just one last thing. I mean, going back to the position on sanctions and so on, I mean, I do think that if we're going to learn the lessons of Mandela, there is a sort of sense in British politics that we're sort of we're beyond all the sort of trials, the tribulations that convulsed South Africa for so long. I mean, here in this country now, we've got battles raging, not about race exactly, but about immigration and so on. Those undercurrents are still present, and I think it behoves Britain and the government to look also at those.
Peter.
Yeah, like this, I mean, it's even bigger than what Mary is saying, which is that if you look back at the 20th century, actually over history, revolutions tend to be incredibly bloody, violent, genocidal very often, torture, political murder, all these things go along. Civil war followed by, look at the Russian Revolution 1917 or the French Revolution. Look at what happened after Tito fell in the Balkans, what happened now in Syria. And yet, and Mandela, he goes in as a sort of liberation fighter into jail in 1964. We don't know what happened really for 30 years. He walks out as a world historical figure. Had he said one wrong thing, or had he given in to? He must have felt anger, hatred. He must have felt these emotions. He just felt only goodness, only love, only forgiveness. If he'd been a different sort of person, South Africa would be where Syria is now, or where Congo has been for so many years. Instead of which it was more difficult. It's more unlikely, I think, that South Africa was going to be non-violent than, say, the Bolshevik Revolution, simply because it had race as well as all the other things, as well as unfairness and class and all the other things which cause revolutions. This makes him such a great man.
I think he is absolutely probably more than anybody, even perhaps Gandhi, the proponent of the great man theory of history, because he did change so much. And he did it, as you've said, from the moment that he came out of jail. I was doing a live... I wasn't in South Africa, I was in London, but when he was came out of jail, we had a live programme. And he was very late, I mean, in terms of the hours, or about an hour or two later than had been expected. And there was just an amazing atmosphere, even though we were in London and he was over there. Almost of disbelief that it was finally happening, but also just a huge feeling that perhaps had come through almost through the prison walls of optimism that made this was a new start. And there were so many people, everybody who was interviewed that day felt this. And gosh, he lived up to expectations so superbly.
Well, of course, the glory and the tragedy of Mandela was that, as you suggest, as Peter said too, was that he was a one-off. If you meet any of a myriad of African leaders today, I've interviewed Paul Kagame and Joseph Kabila of Congo not long ago, and my, you know, all of us could name a dozen more who are simply, you know, not comparable is vastly to understate it, who are almost in a different universe than
Nelson Mandela certainly as a wonderful example of a great man of history. I think that's a perfect moment to leave it. Sue Cameron, Mary Riddell and Peter Oborne, thank you very much.